And thank you for coming, also on a short notice. It's really always a pleasure to come here and talk to people. And so I want to start with this, which thank you, Neil, for introducing me to this illustration. The first time I saw it was when Neil gave a talk at VIS a few months ago, I guess. But it's such a beautiful illustration of artist's conception of what our universe looks like. And then there is the cosmologist's view of our universe. And so the main take home from these pie charts is that there's a tiny sliver of everything we now know from cosmology there is that we really actually understand. This is a sliver of the baryonic matter. Everything else, the dark energy and dark matter, are still big unknowns. They represent new physics. And so what's really exciting in the current state of astrophysics and cosmology is that there's a wealth of measurements. Can we dim it down?
Right there. Try the next one down.
Oh, the way?
Oh, that's where, yeah, sorry.
Let me take a poll. How many of you have been at my talk in December?
Yeah, but it's been a while.
I know,
You have
I
to
know.
remember.
Okay.
We have a short memory, so.
I apologize, guys, for there's going to be a little bit of repetition, but it's setting up for some new stuff, so.
We're both
if you remember.
Okay,
good.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Okay, so there's a wealth of new measurements, galaxy surveys, CMB observations from the ground and from space, these new low-frequency radio arrays that are going after opening up a whole new field of 21-centimeter cosmology, then generation two of direct attraction experiments looking at WIMP-like dark matter. Are starting to ramp up this year and in the coming years. So I'm a theorist, so what the theme of this talk is going to be is making a connection between these various probes that are all going to try to shed light on these big unknowns and the theory. So when I was putting this talk originally, I wanted to give you three talks, but I don't think I'm going to have the time in a reasonable amount of time. So if you want to ask me about CMB probes of microphysics of dark energy, I'm going to be around for the rest of the day. So please come talk to me. But in this talk, I want to tell you about the work that I've done on dark matter, specifically the direct attraction probes and cosmological CMB probes. And then in the second part of the talk, I'm going to switch gears completely and tell you about one new, very exciting result where I have proposed with my collaborators a novel probe to look for primordial magnetic fields. So let me start with dark matter. So what do we know? We know that, so simply put, there is, in some sense, more gravity in the universe than there are baryons. One way to model this is to assume there are new particles. And we know that this has been the case. These particles have been around throughout the cosmic history. We have a lot of negatives that we know about dark matter. We have excluded some scenarios. We also have a lot of ideas what dark matter might be. And the paradigm that I'm going to focus on for this talk is the weakly interacting massive particles, or the WIMP-like particles, by which I really mean, I'll assume that these particles can interact with baryons, however weakly. So just very briefly, the idea of direct attraction is that we live in our galaxy, like any other galaxy, lives in a halo of dark matter. The sun is going around the galactic center, so we should be constantly exposed to the wind of dark matter particles blowing in the opposite direction. And so the idea of direct attraction is take a target of very pure material, as large as you can, surrounded by very sensitive detectors, shield it, stick it underground, and then wait for dark matter particles to occasionally collide with your target nuclei. And so the measurement that all these experiments are going after making is measuring the recoil energy of the target nuclei. And the whole, right, and so this effort is represented by some dozens of experiments worldwide that are just now entering this so-called generation two stage, meaning making bigger targets and more sensitive detectors and collecting data. These These detectors and these experiments are based on a wide variety of technologies. You will have heard about liquid noble gas targets like xenon and argon and so on, such as in the LZ or xenon-1-ton experiments. Then there are others that are based on cryogenically cooled germanium-silicon crystals like super-CDMS. There are bubble chambers like PICO. PICO and super-CDMS are, by the way, in Snow Lab in Canada. And then there are others, again, worldwide. So the main idea of direct transcription boils down to the simple equation where the rate of events that you expect to see is number density and square section times the velocity. However, you have to expand this equation a little bit because you need to integrate over the local velocity of dark matter particles and then account for the local overdensity in the dark matter particles, the rho chi. So on the left-hand side is the observable that all of these experiments are looking to measure, which would be the number counts of recoil events as a function of recoil energy, or in other words, nuclear recoil energy spectrum. On the right-hand side are the astrophysical ingredients that I just mentioned, and then also the particle physics parameters of dark matter, like the cross-section and the mass. And most of these experiments to date have reported null detection, so they have not seen excess events, most of the experiments, have not seen events in excess of what they expected to see from the backgrounds. So from that observation, they were able to exclude portions of the parameter space that correspond to cross-sections for every given mass that correspond to cross-sections that would give you at least that many events as the number of backgrounds they've seen. So this is how the main results for most of the experiments in this generation one look like. Now, the question that got me really interested and got me going into this field is I wanted to know if we do really see a signal with one of these wonderful experiments next couple of years, what is it that we can learn as theorists from these measurements about the theory of dark matter, not just take some simplest assumptions and measure the cross-section and the mass. What can we pull out from the data? And these folks all work with me on various stages of trying to address this question. So going back to this nuclear recoil rate equation, what's traditionally assumed for this cross-section is that it's momentum and velocity independent, either spin-dependent or spin-independent scattering. So you would typically see two exclusion plots, one for spin-independent, one for spin-dependent scattering from these experimental results. However, so what that would mean is, you would expect on the left-hand side that your observable will look like this exponential magenta curve. The number of events that you would see, each energy would look something like that. But the question that I'm asking now is, what if I have two theories that predict different shapes of the recoil energy spectra? Can I tell them apart from direct detection measurements? And data context for asking this question is very important because you can tell these two curves apart when you look at them. However, this is how the best case scenario data would look like on the largest targets that we have right now. So here I've simulated, I've done a realization of the blue curve, including the Poisson noise, the shot noise, for a signal that I put at the current upper limits for this theory, and then assume that I have a ton scale xenon target. So this is the largest target in the field. And this is the level of noise, again, in the best case scenario that you might expect. So just because of the... this is the electric dipole, so it has a momentum separation. Energy. It's just for illustration. I'm just showing you two extreme cases that you can look at. I will tell you more about what.
So one, if you need a pointer, there is one there. But
am I making you nervous when I'm walking back and forth?
No. If you need a pointer. Then,
no, I love walking. It makes me.
That's okay. But the second question. So the question is that what goes into that look curve? So what particular assumptions are you building into your model of dark matter?
So this I'm showing you literally just for illustration two different theories, and I will show you what I'm taking to be my pool of possibilities. Okay, I'll discuss what I mean by different theories. Here I'm just showing you these are two different shapes of recoil energy spectra. that you get from two different interactions. Okay. So this is how the data will look like if we're lucky. But this is another realization from the same blue curve. So you can get a Poisson fluctuation upwards. And so it's no longer clear that you can really easily tell these two curves apart. And bear in mind that we don't know what the cross-section is. We don't know what the mass is. Here, I've plotted these two curves for the same wimp mass and normalizing the cross-section to produce the same number of events. So the question, main question here is, how likely is direct attraction to successfully identify the correct dark matter theory if we're agnostic about what the interaction is, as much as we can be? And then also, how do we analyze the data to address this question? And what experimental strategies help get to success in this way? Now I'm going to tell you a bit about the theory side of this. So in recent years, there's been some turn in the dark matter modeling community towards considering the effective theory of dark matter baryon interactions. And so a bunch of people, some of the work that I've listed down here, have gone ahead and put together the list of all the effective operators that describe elastic scattering of spin 1/2 dark matter particles going up to second order in momentum transfer. So going beyond the two standard case scenarios and sort of trying to figure out what are all the possibilities. And then they also provided us with a calculation of the nuclear response functions, the form factors that you need to use with each one of these different interactions. So this is the first time that there was a consistent way to do calculations for different targets and compare them for these different interaction theories. And then a bunch of other people, and specifically the two people that I worked with in their previous work, have then gone ahead and tried to figure out a list of UV-complete theories that sort of covers as much of this operator space as possible. So they tried to explore what combinations of operators one might be theoretically motivated to look at. And so we've relied on this previous work. We haven't done any modeling exercise in the work that I'm talking about today. This is a list of theories we've collected from previous literature. There is the interaction Lagrangian, and then the various nuclear response functions. So I've included the spin dependent and spin independent. These are the two standard scenarios. And then the aniple dark matter, the dipole, magnetic and electric through heavy or light mediator, and some other a little bit more perhaps exotic scenarios. So the take home from this big table is that what I wanted to do with this collaboration with people who do model building is I wanted a list that sort of covered one in some sense of the possibilities for the various phenomenologies that we can access with direct attraction. So I wanted a list, large list of theories that people might be interested in to look at, and I wanted to see if we can, if the data can isolate the right one.
There are one question. So we have a similar issue on the gravitational front. But so how exhaustive do you think whatever list one can come up with is? I mean, how do you know you're not looking where there is a lamppost and the true theory is somewhere else?
I don't. This is the first attempt of this kind of exercise trying to answer, can we actually isolate the theory and not just analyze the data to get the parameters under a given theory? This is the first analysis that I'm aware of that's of this same kind. So there certainly may be other possibilities. But again, the basis in which this is complete is what I had told you in the previous slide. So these are UV complete theories that encompass a large portion of these 17 different operators that go up to second order momentum transfer. And this is, again, excuse me, this is just for spin 1/2 dark matter and so on. So it's in that sense complete, but not more than that. So no, I don't know.
So the adaptive dimension 6 is that?
I guess that's what you mean by saying up to momentum squared. Squared over some mass constant.
Yeah. So this is how these different, these are the recoil energy spectra that the first eight of these that I showed you in the previous slide, just to avoid clutter, I didn't put all of them. The recoil energy spectra, the first eight of these produce on a variety of different targets, and the lines of the same type on these, so this is for four different targets, xenogermanium, fluorine, and sodium. The lines of the same type represent the same interaction for the same cross-section for the same mass. So you know, you can notice that, you know, different targets, different experiments see a different thing. Then I considered a range of experiments trying to sort of mock up what the reach of the generation two will be. So the most important parameters are the energy window, the threshold in the upper limit, and then the exposure in kilogram years. This involves the mass of the target and the time you're observing. So when I say something like xenon, you should think xenon 1 ton or LZ. When I say germanium, you should think super CDMS. OK, so then the core of the analysis here and the novel thing in this approach was to try to statistically address this question, again, because we don't have data at hand. We want to understand what we can do in principle. So what I've done is I put all the signals at their current upper limit. So everything that I'm going to show you is, again, for the best case scenario, where the signals are as large as they can be. Then I've looked at three different benchmark masses with masses of 20, 50, and 500 GeV just to cover a wider range. And then I've done simulations of data. These are just some examples of what different targets could see for those parameters for each one of the theories in that pool of 14 different hypotheses. Then I analyzed each one of these simulations by fitting each one of the theories, the right one and all the wrong ones for that realization, and trying to figure out whether, you know, the goodness of fit of the right one is by far better than every other theory. Okay, in more technical terms, what I've done is Bayesian model selection, where the free fitting parameters in each case were the mass and the cross-section for every theory. Okay, so now let me show you the key result. I've just selected out one figure, made a lot of these. Okay, so this one takes a few seconds to absorb. Just bear with me. On the horizontal axis, so different columns correspond to analyzing simulated simulations on different targets or a combined likelihood analysis on two targets or three targets at once. On the vertical axis is the posterior probability for the true underlying model. So all the information that was used to create this graph was obtained from simulations for, in this case, for the standard spin-independent interaction. And each one of the simulations was fit by that long list of hypotheses. And the probabilities for that right interaction versus all the other hypotheses was then compared, and so this is the posterior probability that the data assigns to the right underlying model. Different lines correspond to different realizations of the same data set on the same target, so the spread tells you just the effects of Poisson noise. You could end up here, you could end up there, just depending on the Poisson noise. So a good outcome is if you see a pileup of lines high at high values. That means that regardless of the realization, the data tends to confidently pick out the right underlying model. And the first take-home point is that doesn't happen for either germanium, xenon, or any other experiment on its own. And it doesn't happen when the two largest exposures in the field are combined either. Situation starts getting drastically improved once iodine and fluorine targets are added to the mix. And this is the specific thing about them is that they have unpaired protons and have more sensitivity to some of the models that are otherwise, to have different sensitivity to the models that are otherwise degenerate on xenon and germanium. So for example, for fluorine, fluorine is very sensitive to spin-dependent interactions. While xenon has no idea if we're talking about spin-dependent or spin-independent. It infers maybe a different cross-section. but it doesn't differ then because their shape, recoil energy spectrum shape, is different. Is sorry, the same, similar. There is some uncertainty in the nuclear calculation. We've been asked about this by the referee and by a lot of other people. We try to quantify. So in order to actually answer this question, how much the uncertainty in the calculation of nuclear form factors affects the results, you would need to quantify it in some way, parameterize it in some way, and then perhaps add a few parameters in your fitting routine, and then marginalize over those parameters. But what we did do is estimated whether it would actually impact model selection or not. And I'll answer you in two slides a little bit better than this. So
just a quick curiosity, what does it mean to be expensive? These calculations, how long do they take? I mean, when you make up these models?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for, let's see, so on a single core, one fit for about 300 events. It depends on how many events you have. At most, on xenon targets, you have about 300, maybe a little bit more. It takes about 15 minutes or something like that. But then I'm fitting 14 different models to each one of the simulations. I'm running many simulations for each one of the models, so you can do the math from there. It's not terribly expensive. It just takes me a day to reproduce all the plots in my on 1,000 cores. So it's not something you want to do repeatedly. It could be done, but.
Well, some of us run for a few months. So
oh, yeah, no, I am living in a different regime than you are. No. Oh, yeah, so when I say computationally expensive, not compared to numerical relative.
Is there something important that it distinguished the iodine and the fluorine?
Why is one. Better. Oh yeah. So I wouldn't read into it too much. If you think about it, how would you put them on the same footing? Would you make them the same same exposure? We can't make perhaps we can't make sodium iodide crystals as large as bubble chambers are right now. So it's not. So the attempt here was to sort of be realistic about what given technology might reach, and that means I trigger complaints in all possible experimental people, but try to do as best as I can. So they're not the same exposures, and I try to see what is reasonable to do with them. So if you tell me of a way to put them on the same footing, I can then maybe put the same exposures. I don't know what happens if I put the same exposures. I don't have the answer to that, but I don't think that's the right question to ask. All right, so. Okay, so now going back, so what is the information that we can actually learn from these experiments? And I've told you that model selection is really hard in this very agnostic analysis. So if I go back to this plot where I've plotted the recoil energy spectra for a variety of theories for the same dark matter mass, you can sort of see that there are bunches of lines, several bunches of lines. In other words, there are several different classes of momentum dependence in the cross section. So there are these interactions that are momentum suppressed. There are some that have light mediators that have a lot of events at very low energies, and then there are the standard ones. And so, if I recast the previous slide in slightly different format, this is what I get. Now, what I'm showing you here is the very same simulations for spin-independent interaction analyzed in the very same way. So all the same content. I'm only showing you germanium xenon and the combination of the two. But on the vertical axis, I am now summing the probabilities for each one of the models in the same momentum class. Okay, so this answers the question of what are the prospects for identifying the momentum dependence of the interaction. And you can see that especially once you combine germanium and xenon, you start doing pretty well. Now, to answer your question about the nuclear physics calculation, notice that what I'm saying is not positive at all. I'm not telling you that we're going to go ahead and figure out the theory of dark matter as soon as we get direct detection data. And the opposite, I'm saying that this is going to be a very hard problem. So adding uncertainty from nuclear physics is not going to help that. But what's positive that I'm saying that you might wonder about is this point. And this point, the momentum dependence doesn't actually get the information about momentum dependence doesn't get destroyed by when I vary my nuclear responses within the, you know, uncertainties that people usually quote. And this is a qualitative answer, so take it with a grain of salt. Okay, final point here. If you analyze your data assuming your wrong interaction model, you end up inferring wrong masses. So this is not very surprising, but it is a cautionary note to, you know, if we want to compare the data from direction detection for with other experiments, we should make sure that we do a good job here. Okay, one product of this analysis was that Samuel McDermott and I have put together the first code that lets you do these kinds of calculations and includes all these nuclear response functions that we call DMDD. It's a Python tool. It's very easy to install. It's on GitHub, or you can just pip install DMDD and use it. There's a tutorial, and the PICO collaboration has already used it for their most recent publication. So that's out there now. Okay, so the summary of everything I've said so far is that identifying the right theory with this marvelous direct detection data is going to be a very hard problem. Even in the best case scenario where the signal is very large. However, then after, you know, I finished this work, I started thinking about, okay, what are those models that are degenerate to each other? And for example, one line of degeneracy in the pool of models that I looked at were the spin-independent, spin-dependent, and Anapol model. And it turns out that Anapol has a different velocity dependence. So an idea that I had at that point was, okay, so maybe we could use the time information, the annual modulation, and I'll come to it in a second in a bit more detail, to try to pull apart these models that have the same momentum dependence, but a different velocity dependence. So what that boils down to, if you look back at the rate equation, is when you have non-trivial velocity dependence, you sort of have an effectively different velocity distribution that you're integrating over. So the idea of annual modulation is that not only does the sun go around the galactic center, but the Earth goes around the sun. And so in June, its velocity aligns up with the direction of solar motion. So we're moving a little faster with respect to the wind. In December, we're moving along with the wind. So there's the annual modulation of there should be an annual modulation in the number counts of events that we see in direct detection experiments. And so this past summer, I had a student, an undergrad from Princeton, work with me to explore this. And she made this neat animation of the residual number counts per energy bin for the spin independent and the Anapol models. And what you should take from this plot is that for different choices of parameters, you might end up with a situation where the phase of the modulation is drastically different. And so now, this spring, at the UCLA conference, I got a grad student interested, Samuel Witte from UCLA, in looking into this a little bit more. And so he made these plots where now he's showing the total number counts, so integrated overall energy, the residual in percents as a function of time, fraction of the year, for on xenon for two different dark matter masses. The red is the Anapol, the blue is the spin independent. So for heavy particles for 500 GeV, you flip the phase. For a little lighter particles, the amplitude of the modulation signal is very different. So there's, you know, this was sort of a hint to us that, okay, maybe we should look into this more quantitatively. So then the next step he's done is he modified my DMDD code to include the analysis of the time signal, to include the simulations of the annual modulation and also the analysis of them. And so these are some very preliminary results that we just got last week. What I'm showing here is the very similar analysis to what I showed you before, but with a single target. This is generation 3, so we've increased here the exposure. But what you should notice is that the column on the right, so the only two models that were considered were the Anapol and the spin independent, the two that are indistinguishable on a xenon target alone. On the right-hand side is the analysis without time. On the left-hand side is what happens when you add annual modulation. So this looks promising, and we're So this is generation 2 is another factor of 10 past the current generation, so like 10,000 kilogram years. This is in the plans. This is not a, you know, it's the next generation. Yes. Sorry. Go ahead.
So here you're fitting the mass of the dark particle, right? Yeah. And then compared to
I'm fitting for the mass. The mass is a free fitting parameter.
Oh, and both come out with the same mass? And I'm just trying to confuse with the top label of the plot that is mass 500 GeV.
That's the underlying model.
That's the
underlying.
That's
trying
the
to,
truth.
Trying
that's
to
the
fit
input.
To the
mm-hmm.
model
that's
from
the input into the simulations. That's the input into the simulations. So I have to create simulations somehow, right? But then when I'm analyzing, I wanna do it as if people would do it with the real data. So I'm letting the mass be a free-fitting parameter, yes, and the cross-section.
So I cannot mock up the modulation with a different model that has a different mass?
No, that's
part
of
what
the
this
point.
Is showing.
Yes. Okay. Sorry,
sorry. The, on the right, I thought you said these two models were not distinguishable if you don't take the time into account, but on the right, it seems like, you know, 80% of the time, you still get the right model.
So the way you should read this axis is this is the probability assigned to the true model. So a lot of the times, I don't know what the percentage is of the lines that are bunched up around 80%. A lot of the times, you are 80% certain that it's spin independent as opposed to n-able. What I'm saying is that you really get very close to 100%, a large fraction of the times once you include the.
I mean, I can see that's better, but I mean, if they're really indistinguishable, I would think the one without time could be clustered or spread all over or clustered around 50% or something like that.
Right. So it's not completely agnostic. The plots that I've previously shown are for smaller xenon targets. As you increase the target, you're increasing your statistic, and so you're doing a lot better. You start moving upwards. But if I were to, you know, if I were a truly honest Bayesianist, I may have used some of those fancy words and put this Bayesian distinction criteria and told you that this is really crappy. I'm not doing that because I believe in saying, you know, what is the probability of the model? This is the number that makes sense to me. So I'm telling you, this is how well you do. You can call it good or bad, but you do a lot better when you add it. I'm not putting in backgrounds in this analysis at all. Okay. And this is not yet below the neutrino backgrounds, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And it's a very, you know, like, this is a lot of events of the signal. So maybe you would expect backgrounds to be by far subdominant. So I don't expect them to change this particular result very much. But maybe you should worry about backgrounds if you're talking about very low threshold germanium experiments and things like that. So yes, that will make things more difficult.
Is the assumption is that the WIMPs themselves have an isotropic velocity distribution? And are local velocity?
Yeah, so they have Maxwell-Boltzmann, yeah, isotropic. In the frame of the galaxy. We can discuss that. Which brings me kind of to the next point that I'm going to really quickly skim over because this is work in progress. But when you analyze direct detection data, when you try to learn something from it, you have to assume velocity distribution. You're probing dark matter locally. There are cosmological probes of dark matter, and the same physics of scattering could be happening in the early universe. And if so, it could be affecting the CMB anisotropies, for example. And people have looked into this before. In particular, if you have baryon dark matter scattering, there's a momentum transfer between the two fluids, and you end up exerting an additional drive force in the baryons, and you suppress perturbations on small scales. Now, the work so far has mostly focused on individual specific models, and all of it, as far as the CMB data is concerned, has looked into just the temperature. What I'm working on now with Kim Body from the University of Hawaii is in extending these kinds of analysis in preparation to analyze the active pole data, which will give us a better handle on much smaller scales where the effect is larger. And what we also want to do is do the same kind of agnostic analysis in a sense and try to, rather than constraining individual models, try to constrain the effective theory of dark matter interactions. And so what this addition of polarization should help us do is push down in the regions of parameter space that are not explored with direct attraction. And in particular, also previous analyses have stopped at the proton mass. What we want to do is push lower to lower dark matter masses. Okay. Part one conclusion is that I guess the one sentence summary would be that we need to, because dark matter, question of what dark matter is obviously a hard problem. A lot of people are working on it. What we need to do is consider every available information that we have, and ideally, you know, do when we are making statements about exclusions, comparing our data sets, we should be doing so in a unified way. And so one of the goals of this work long term would be to enable the first combined analysis of cosmological and direct attraction data. Okay, how much time do I have? How much time do I spend in this room?
I think we're aiming for 10 minutes. Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
When did you start?
20 minutes.
So 20 minutes?
20 minutes from now.
Ah, well noticed. Oh, 20 minutes. Yeah, that's it, 20 minutes. Yeah, I have to go at the...
Okay, are there any other questions about
a dark matter? Yeah, let me just ask a question again, because bugging us on this outcome. Is there any chance for eventually trying the inverse problem, where you just are agnostic, you get enough data, and then you say, I don't care about what the theories are telling me, I'm just going to let the data guide my search.
But what exactly do you mean by that?
I have signals, and then I just look at particular features, how we might have modulations or not, and from there try to work out from the bottom up.
This is sort of the attempt to do that.
No, but
you would have to parameterize in some, you know, like when people talk about this like model free or whatever reconstruction, you would need to parameterize things in some way. So if you have a way of doing that, you know, maybe I can, you know, how would I don't even know where I would begin. If I don't have
right.
some...
But that might be the most exciting thing. I mean, this is where we are also on the gravitational wave count.
Right.
But it's perhaps the most exciting question.
Right, but you're using the...
No, I'm not. I mean, that's precisely the point. Now
okay.
we have data that is very clean and is very pristine, which we did not think would be the case with LIGO, but we would hoping it would happen with LISA. But if you have it with LIGO, then you can begin saying, well, can I be agnostic completely about the theory and then try to do the inverse problem? Have a signal. What is the underlying theory of gravity that's governing whatever is going on?
Yeah, I don't know what that would mean at this point, but maybe we should talk about it. What exactly is it?
Maybe try to translate. I think what you're doing is classifying all the effective field theories,
mm-hmm.
or trying to. Maybe there would be parameterizations which are even simpler than that. In other words, if you don't really want the Lagrangian, nor that it's UV complete, but all you want is, you know, measures of cross section, mass, basically that, some plausible parameterization of the most general possible cross section. You know, the virtue of effective field theory is you know that it's consistent with relativity and
mm-hmm.
quantum mechanics, and so at least
mm-hmm.
that's okay.
Yeah,
but nevertheless, some simpler parameterization
Perhaps you can ask questions about momentum dependence or velocity
mm-hmm.
dependence
mm-hmm.
So those things, so you just use general functions that just depend on recoil momentum or
right.
energy
right.
and you can fit
you mean
those.
Fit for various shapes of, for example, the cross section dependence
see the overall shape
mm-hmm.
just forget about the underlying theory and say do I have a bump or not at certain recoil
I like that yeah I like that. Yeah, it's just that this was statistical enough for the field already, and something that hasn't been done and thought of in this way. And it was my best first attempt to do this, but I do like that idea.
Yeah, maybe we should go beyond quantum field. There are proposals. I mean, not that I'm advocating it, but Eric Valinde has a model for dark matter involving reptation of polymers. This has nothing to do with quantum field theory.
Yes.
So, we'll be able to look at that. But it would be parameterizable, presumably, in terms of,
No, no, we can be agnostic. Let's not put any fancy words. Let's just say some function that depends on Q and even coil. How is that?
Guys, let me tell you about primordial magnetic fields. Okay, so let me give you a very short story here. 21 centimeter tomography. The idea is before the universe got reionized, it was neutral since the last scattering. And neutral hydrogen, atomic hydrogen, has this line emission from this forbidden transition from the triplet to singlet state in the ground state, this hyperfine structure. And so the idea of 21 centimeter tomography is to map out the density field in the universe at very high redshifts, above redshift of 7 up to, you know, the dark ages, the so-called dark ages of the universe, at redshifts of 20 or 30. Using, you know, the measurements, the intensity mapping of the redshifted 21 centimeter signal. And there are a lot of experiments that are hoping to make the first statistical detection in the next few years. There are plans for the next generations. So this is, you know, this field, the 21 centimeter cosmology, is one of the next frontier fields in cosmology. So now, why primordial magnetic fields? Magnetic fields are ubiquitous in our universe. Our universe is magnetized on various scales. But origins of the magnetic fields in the present-day universe are still not fully resolved. In particular, some of the standard paradigms, or the standard paradigm is that we got the present-day, for example, galactic magnetic fields by amplifying some seed fields. And the seed fields could be coming from some primordial mechanisms or from structure formation. But the primordial mechanisms typically produce very weak magnetic fields. And the current upper limits are on the order of maybe 10 to the minus 9, 10 to the minus 10 Gauss. So there's a lot of orders of magnitude to go before we can hope to make a detection. What I want to tell you about is a new method that proposes to use the 21 centimeter tomography with these upcoming and future experiments to probe truly minuscule magnetic field strengths, and especially is sensitive to magnetic fields that are coherent on large scales and present in the high redshift intergalactic medium. And when I say minuscule strengths, I mean order of 10 to the minus 21 Gauss and smaller. And I'll tell you where that number comes from in just a second, but these are the folks that all worked on this. It was a series of two papers. The microphysics calculation was led by Tejev and Umarov at EIAS. The detectability calculation was led by me. And I want to summarize both of these very briefly. But again, the main idea is this. There's a triplet, excited state, and a singlet. The triplet has a net magnetic moment. So if you want to think about it classically, very heuristically, when the atom is in the triplet state, it has a net magnetic moment. When it emits, to decay back to singlet, it'll emit preferentially in the equatorial plane around this mu. And so there's a memory sort of the incident direction of the radiation. If you irradiate an ensemble of atoms isotropically with 21 centimeter radiation, they excite such that the directions of these magnetons are randomly ordered, are random. However, if you immerse them in a quadrupolar anisotropy, so you give a little more radiation from this side, a little less from the bottom, then what happens is that they tend to align parallel, antiparallel to this direction that connects the cold spots. And this is exactly the circumstance that you have at high redshifts. There are density perturbations in the universe. Here I'm depicting them with this background shading. So imagine an ensemble of atoms riding on the crest of a density wave. There's quadrupolar anisotropy in the surrounding 21 centimeter radiation just because stuff is falling towards the overdensity. So they see a little less Hubble expansion in this direction than in the perpendicular one. And so they end up lining up to some degree along the crest of the wave. I have not mentioned magnetic fields yet. Now I'm going to do that. If I put in now an ambient magnetic field that has a coherence length that's larger than the scale of the density perturbations here, the atoms will start processing about this direction. And so when they decay back to the ground state, the rescattered quadrupole that they emit is now offset from the incident one. And this is the main, this is the key of tracking the magnetic fields at high ratchets. Now, let me tell you very quickly where this number of 10 to minus 21 comes from before I mention any experiment. Can I draw something on the board? OK, so the Larmor, can you hear me still? OK. The Larmor precession is going to be the diamagnetic ratio of the electron times the magnetic field, where this is order of 10 to the 7 in what is it, radians per second. And then omega is just the angle of precession divided by the time. And here's where the magic comes in. The time scale, the time baseline that you have for this effect to happen is huge. And that's because this is a forbidden transition. The lifetime, typically at redshift of 20, of the excited state is on the order of 30,000 years. This is including a variety of effects. So this is not just the Einstein coefficient inverted. It will be around, you know, a million or 10 million years.
Is that the relevant time scale, though? Because if you have collisions that make the loose polarization and things like that, then it should be
that the Einstein scale. I have included that in here. I have included all of it. This was my point. Yes. The lifetime with the excited state, including everything else that can mess it up, is on that order. So
No, there is a slightly different question. It's not just the lifetime of the state. It's not just something that will be excited. It's anything that will use loss of direction.
Which includes the collisions and, you know, absorbing and Lyman alpha photon and other stuff.
Yeah, okay.
So this is really just an order of magnitude. Everything comes out very nicely to agree with this, but yeah, this is just an order of magnitude. So let's see, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 11.
Yeah. Huh? Don't de-excite the atom, but rotate its polarity.
Yes, exactly. This is what I'm saying.
Leave it in the triplet state.
Yes.
So
you've included those. This is what you're
yes,
saying.
We have included the modeling of the collisions. Yes.
Those things enter the just like natural lifetime. So Vera said lifetime. I'm assuming she means lifetime plus collision time scale.
No, there are different time scales. For example, because this is a precession, like if you do nuclear magnetic resonance, there are different time scales that have to do with how much it takes to lose direction, net direction, let's say if you have spin aligns this way, or how much does it take to lose coherence in precession. So there are different time scales.
I agree there are different time scales, but that's not what I said. I said they enter many of the observable things in a form that looks a lot like lifetime. So you could be forgiven for calling it lifetime.
Ah, okay.
But it is not.
Okay.
But it is those.
What I'm saying is the same number actually comes from the exact equation. I'm now using the time.
Okay. No, just clarify.
The effect.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So if you say, if I want to figure out what is the magnetic field that you give me order one radian of precession in this lifetime, if you forgive me calling you that way, then I get the B, so if I stick that back in here, this 10 to minus 12, 10 to minus 7, I get the order of 10 to minus 19 Gauss. This is in physical units. So now if I assume the adiabatic evolution, then you have to divide this by, I was saying, order 10, so the redshift squared. So this is where that number comes from. Again, in the order of magnitude, this is where we started working on this. Okay, so now the key result of the first paper here was to compute the temperature, brightness temperature, emission pattern. So n is the direction, line of sight in the frame of the emitting atoms, and k is the wave vector. So we've included all the usual physics that people who do 21 centimeter cosmology calculations do, the radiative transitions, the atomic collisions, the Lyman alpha pumping, but then we just added the magnetic fields as well. And that's represented in this last term here. So if you wanted to evaluate this equation, yeah. You're gonna have to let me do this a little more. There's the same equations as on the next one. Yeah, a little more qualitative. Then we can talk technical details afterwards. But I just want to make my point. So you need to fold in the spin temperature, the kinetic temperature of the IGM, Lyman alpha flux evolution, whatever you think that is. So you need to assume some randomization history. You need to have some way of statistically representing the matter fluctuations, the delta up there, that drive the fluctuations in the brightness temperature, so that you get from the matter power spectra from CAM or other Boltzmann solver. And so if I now show you just what this quadrupolar emission pattern looks like, again, this is just for visual. So here, from the top to the bottom panel, I have cranked up the magnetic field strength, going from zero to something large in this sense. And so I started here with the configuration. This is the Mulready projection of sphere onto this ellipsoid. So if you're not used to CMB, this is the full sphere. The K vector comes out of a hot spot. And the direction of the magnetic field here is in the vertical direction. So as you crank up the magnetic field, you end up scrambling the directions. You process many times before you decay, if you want to think about it. Again, heuristically in the classical picture. And so you end up going from that quadrupole to a different one, and you saturate the effect. So I can do the computation of what the saturation level is, which is sort of what I've been doing here on the board. And that comes out to be around 10 to the minus 20, 21 Gauss in comoving units. But what I want you to notice here is that once I saturate, I no longer know if I'm cranking up the field anymore. So I have no sensitivity to distinguishing stronger magnetic fields. But I still can tell this picture apart from the one on top. So there is a prospect for putting a lower limit as well, not just this kind of sensitive measurement. OK, this is my words summary of paper 2 that deals with figuring out the whole quadratic estimator formalism in a very similar manner as to what we do with the CMB analysis. That'll recover the magnetic field, either a uniform magnetic field or one that's stochastic and has a particular arbitrary power spectrum. But basically, as you could have already guessed from the previous plots, a magnetic field will introduce a preferred direction, an anisotropy. And a stochastic magnetic field, for those of you who might have thought about the CMB estimators, produces cross correlations between different Fourier modes that wouldn't be there otherwise. OK, I'm going to have to skip over the technical slide, which is equivalent to what I've just said before. So we've done all those calculations. And so these are the key results. So here, I'm showing you a calculation where we've assumed an array of dipoles in a compact grid configuration, so packed together, kind of like the images that you may have seen from Hera or some of the other experiments, FFT telescope and others. On the horizontal axis is the maximum array baseline. So if you want to know what the collecting area, what the area that's covered in dipoles is, you should square this. And on the vertical axis is the one sigma sensitivity or one sigma threshold for a uniform magnetic field in the entire survey volume. This is a very optimistic case. That's the red line. And then the top gray line is for a magnetic field with a scale-independent power spectrum of fluctuations, just as an example, no particular reason, just as an example of stochastic. Can I show you this at the end? I'll pull up the equations, and I want to show you exactly, because I know you will ask me more details about this if I'm not totally thorough. OK, so what I want you to take from this plot is that about a square kilometer array of dipole antennas that have a wide field of view, this is one of the key things, can reach order of just below the saturation limit at the one sigma level. OK, so to make a detection, you would need to go maybe 6, 7 square kilometers or something like that to make a few sigma detection, 5 sigma detection or something. It's right. So I assumed that we're integrating between 15 and 25. Yeah. So there's no. It's mostly neutral, and that's the idea because we're, yeah. Okay, so this is really probing the magnetic field in the dark ages. Okay, so that's one key result. But then, as I sort of alluded to before, you may then ask, What about the stronger magnetic fields? Is this method just good for very tiny ones? And so that goes back to the story about what happens when you reach saturation. When you reach saturation, the question to ask can no longer be what is the magnetic field, what's the one sigma value to measuring the magnetic field, because you can't do that. But what you can do is ask the question of what is the sensitivity to distinguishing saturation from no magnetic fields, in which case you can then place a lower limit that corresponds to the saturation level at the given redshift. And so this plot answers that question. So this psi parameter quantifies the level of distinction between the no magnetic case signal and the no magnetic field case and the large magnetic field case. So it's bound to be between 0 and 1, where 1 corresponds to the saturation and 0 corresponds to no magnetic fields. So the lower this line is, the more confidence you would have to making a statement about the lower limit on the field. Okay, so the way that I read this plot, again, the x-axis is the same as the maximum ray baseline. Square that if you want to get the collecting area. But 1 square kilometer array reaches a little over 1 sigma confidence to being able to identify saturation and exclude no magnetic field case. Okay, and this is where I'm wrapping up. So one last point I wanted to emphasize here is that this all seems magical, but really what I've told you is this effect is based on the second order process. So it goes as tau squared. So it's a suppressed effect. It's a small effect. It's order 10 to the minus 3 fractional correction to the 2-point statistic. But once you reach that level of sensitivity, or that level of quality in the 21 centimeter statistics, then that opens up a way to probing magnetic fields of that order of magnitude. Okay, so I guess in summary, on the one hand, there's a vast space for discovery cosmology. On the other hand, there's tons of precision tools that we have right now, and many more coming up in the near future, and planned for the years ahead to come. So it's a very exciting time to be trying to make a connection between theory and data. Thank you. Let me just move to another. Oh, good. I will. I'll show you.
I would like to. I think we've asked many questions during the talk.
Okay.
So, any more questions?
So I have questions for you.
You have questions.
It's a reverse seminar.
No. It's just think like students. Okay. I don't know how we deal with nuclear form factors. How would you properly account for nuclear form factors if you arbitrarily parameterize your cross section?
I don't know.
You got me intrigued. I like the idea. This is right on.
Form factors momentum dependent.
What's that?
Are nuclear form factors momentum dependent?
Yeah.
They should be too. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
But
maybe.
There's several people, by the way, that do look at this stuff, nuclear form factors, mm-hmm. because they're important for many accelerator experiments,
yeah.
heavy ion collisions, and all sorts of things. So I think there is a lot of research. I don't think, though, there is any expert in this room on this subject, though, I'm not sure. But there is a lot of research, and it's a tough thing. I'll just say it's not, trivial.
Yeah, I don't.
There are several things that come
don't.
Also from neutron scattering experiments, right? Because they're important in 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 such facilities, or?
Yeah, all right.
I mean, I guess my point, well, the point that we're trying to think on the gravity side is that if, in that case, you have one theory that is supposedly, or you think is a preferred one, but now if you want to ask, okay, what else if not this one? You can look at all the possibilities people have been writing down, many of which make no sense, but nevertheless, you go and look at them. Or you can just be agnostic with respect to them. You just take motivations from them on the qualitative level. So what differences are these different theories of intuition?
And
then just throwing them away and building up a phenomenon, as Neil was saying.
But the thing is, with what you're talking, I think I can imagine that how I would go about it, and I don't think I can imagine it immediately for this particular case. Like if I were doing this, you know, for example, for scattering, you know, for early universe scattering, you know, you just have protons, and you know, I don't know, maybe this would be an easier first step to do something. And in fact, people have actually looked at, you know,
Early universe depends a lot on the model now, because you the effective operators that you write down may break down. In some of these, you have light mediators, heavy mediators, right?
But couldn't you ask the same question?
You could, but then it depends. The question is there, does the freeze-out happen during Big Bang nucleosynthesis? Then nuclear form factors would matter. Before that...
When I say early universe, I mean later than that.
You mean later than that? When you say early universe, for me, it's like very early.
That's fair, yeah.
You mean for CMB times?
I don't know. It's something to think about.
I don't know. I haven't thought about that.
You guys can go have lunch.
Yeah. Can you show the coherence line?
Oh, yeah. Right.
Show me that.
Yeah, let me show you.
Can I ask about that also? I'm not sure the same thing, but about you said at some point that the coherence line of the magnetic field can be longer than the density perturbation.
Yes. Right? So that's a condition. That's a condition. Okay. So wait. So that's a condition for your calculation to be valid, which means that if you're talking about coherence lengths that are small, then you better be using fluctuations on with smaller wavelengths, right? So it's just a statement of that there has to be this hierarchy of scales for the calculation to be valid. So that'll limit if you're using smaller coherence length fields, then you should better make sure that, you know, maybe you're using very small small-scale data. And this is why it's like optimal for large scales. It's optimal for large scales because we observe large scales. This is a, let me show you this.